I'm Scott Schiff, substituting for Atlas Society CEO Jennifer Grossman. Thank you for joining us today. We are very pleased to have Atlas Society founder David Kelly. This is an Ask Me Anything. So, you know, I have some questions that come in from Instagram and other channels. Of course, we invite anyone with a question up to the stage. And, you know, honestly, I could probably come up with questions for you myself for an hour, but we do want this to be interactive. So if you'd like to join, please raise your hand. David, I'm just going to go ahead and, you know, start with one of the Instagram questions. This is from DeLong89, and it's, how does an objectivist know if they are being completely rational?
Oh, that's a great question. I think there's no simple answer because, for one thing, rationality is a matter of choice in the choice to focus and to be objective, that is to focus yourself on facts. But we are also not just minds, but we are living things with emotions and desires and goals that can sometimes, you know, interfere with our rationality. In, for example, we have a viewpoint. There's a fact of the fact in the world that is really uncomfortable or painful to consider, and so we have the capacity to evade it and the motivation to do that as well. And so being rational means being as alert as possible to the non-rational factors that may be operating in a given situation that you're in, whether it's a practical choice, a decision you're making about your life, or whether it's a intellectual issue where you've been committed to a set of ideas for a long time, and then you hear evidence or arguments that weigh against it, and you have to consider them, or you can shut them out. So rationality is partly a matter of will, of choice, but it requires an alertness to also the compromising factors that can interfere with rationality. And, you know, no two people are the same this way. We have different temperaments, different situations, different histories, different problems that we've encountered and may have, that may include psychological problems. So that alertness, it's hard to specify in detail. But that's what the practice of rationality over time means. I would also add that rationality is also a skill involving the ability to weigh evidence, being logical. Logic is a skill. I'm a logic teacher, and I know that it's a learned ability. And so acquiring the skill and expanding one's skill and knowledge is a part of rationality in objectivism. And so it's kind of an ongoing project of value. Reason is a value in objectivism. It's not just a virtue of practicing rationality. It's right. Developing your own mind, your own reason, and your ability, expanding your ability to be rational is a lifelong project. Just it's part of being alive and pursuing your own happiness. So one thing, however, I would caution against is self-imposed guilt, especially retrospective guilt about a bad decision you might have made or a bad choice you might have made, when in the context, it was not, maybe you didn't know something. Now you do. Well, don't go back and blame yourself for something you didn't know at the time. So just be as open as possible about the world. The world's out there. It's your friend. It's not your enemy. Reality is not your enemy. But you are not your enemy either. I'll leave it there, Scott.
That's fair. It's a huge question. It just, like you said, it was a good question. I thought it was good from the listener. So I at least wanted to start off with something substantive. Not that they're all not substantive, but we've got some people up in the audience. So let's just start, going with some live questions. Roger, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah. Hey, here's a question for David. I pose this to others, and I'd love to get your take on this. One of the more popular public intellectuals these days is Jordan Peterson. And I've read his books, and I've heard his lectures, and I find him to be interesting on certain topics. But one of the things that he says that I disagree with, but I still have a hard time rejecting him holistically because I do like some of the things he has to say, is when he talks about pursuing what is meaningful versus what makes you happy. And when I think of, like, I know there's a difference between, temporal pleasure, but happiness is this thing that Aristotle talked about and Rand talks about quite a bit. And I'd love to get your position when it comes to this idea that Peterson paints out, which is that if you pursue what is meaningful, that is more important than those things that make you happy. If you have any thoughts on that, I'd love to hear your perspective on it.
Oh, the great question, Roger. Thank you. And I do have thoughts on that because I think it's a false dichotomy. If Peterson, and I'm not familiar with this aspect of his thinking, I have to admit that up front, but if he means by happiness just pleasure, momentary pleasure, that is not, as you said, that's not the Aristotelian, and it's not the objectivist view. Happiness is a state of satisfaction in one's life over a longer term. And I've got a siren in the background where I'm living in the middle of Washington, D.C. Happiness is, by contrast with pleasure is momentary, happiness is longer term. But also, and more importantly, happiness involves having meaningful goals that give meaning to your life. So the pursuit of meaning and the pursuit of happiness are not two separate things. What's meaningful to us is the pursuit of purposes in our lives. And those purposes can involve production and work, or objectivism, that's a pretty central purpose. But also relationships, love, family, civic engagement, a range of other things, where the result of pursuing meaning and succeeding in achieving what's meaningful to you is the very source of happiness. Happiness, in Ayn Rand's definition, is the consequence of pursuing and achieving your values. And values are what give life meaning. So I would reject the kind of premise behind the question. Does that get to your point?
Roger?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know if you guys can hear me, but no, that was precisely what I wanted to hear. I've asked that question, and you gave me exactly what it was. So I'll reflect on that in this conversation.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Roger. Appreciate that. Let's just go right down the line while we've got people here. Lawrence?
Hello, am I coming through quiet or...
Maybe a hair quiet, but it's not terrible.
Okay, so my question is, sort of talks on, we spoke last week about sort of religion as a primitive form of philosophy and sort of, you know, the way man has tried to describe the world around him and how they should conduct themselves. And this seems to be universal across the world, no matter where you go. And it made me think sort of from, I guess, more of an anthropological perspective, as we've advanced and come into what we would like to think is a more an age of reason, we have seen people move away from religion, but seemingly not towards reason. And they come up with these sort of non-theistic religions, what I would argue, sort of like how people act when it comes to what you could say, like the church of wokeness. And I'm curious, what would your take on that be? Is it more so that there's just been a failure of education to prime people to use their reason? Or is there something more fundamental there?
Another great and complicated question. Let me make a couple points that may address this. Ayn Rand, and I think most objectivists, despite our disagreement with the supernatural beliefs of religion and the moral code of sacrifice that many religions preach, nevertheless regard it as providing people with a framework for life. And human beings need that. They need to know, because of our nature, our rational nature, and the fact that we can see ourselves in part of a much larger world, and we also see our lives as having a beginning and an end. We can anticipate, and so questions about life after death and all of those things come up. Religion provides a framework. It's not fully rational, but it's at least a framework. And so that's why Rand called it a primitive version of philosophy. It serves or addresses certain actual real human cognitive needs for that framework and for a coherent moral code. The reason I think that in moving away from religion and to the extent that's happening in our culture has not produced, you know, a complete acceptance of reason is a couple of things. One is religion in the the philosophers in the 19th and 20th century in the West did not pick up on the Enlightenment late 18th century confidence in reason. And in many ways, there was a counter Enlightenment that taught new forms of irrationality, new systems of subjectivism and faith. And so we got things like in our own day or recent decades, new agey stuff. People sign on to conspiracy theories as another example. And they're not really taught or encouraged to think in a fully rational way and fully conceptual way. And so that's more of a result of bad philosophy than of religion per se. But also another factor is that religion taught altruism and that it's sacrifice, the nobility of sacrifice. And that has persisted in all kinds of secular forms. The socialist movement was based on the altruism of sacrificing for the good of the country or the good of the working class or the good of whatever. Now we have environmentalism, which preaches in sacrifice for the good of the environment. And that idea of self-interest as evil versus sacrifice as good has a secular form. Its roots may be in religion, but it has persisted despite and in many other forms than religion. So That's why we have that's Lawrence, I think that's why we're seeing the phenomenon that you described. I will say though that one of the paradoxes is that at least in Western countries, in the US especially, people do tend to have an individualist streak. They seek well-being in their lives. They want a good living. They're not embarrassed by money, or up to a certain point anyway. And so they work in a fully rational way in their jobs. I mean, think of just all the technology we have, all the medicines, including the vaccine, COVID vaccines that were developed in an amazing speed. Those were works of incredible rationality, but some of the people who achieved those feats of rationality in their work then go home and, you know, go to church meetings or to Flat Earth Society meetings or whatever, you know, non-rational thing they appeals to them as providing their ethics, their spiritual life, and so forth. It's a very mixed situation.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, David. Dana, do you have a question for Dr. Kelly? Are you there, Dana? All right. Well, I think we'll move to Roger Hunt and see if Dana comes back in a minute.
All right, Dana, jump in. All right. So I guess you talked about rationality a lot, and that first question kicked into it, and now I can't stop thinking about it. All right, so here's my question. When you were talking about rationality, you added a lot of stuff that might be ethics, like, you know, developing a skill, holding yourself accountable. And I was wondering if you could put yourself in maybe a little dialogue with a group that would say, you know, rationality is just making sure you've got your subjects and verbs all in the right order, and you're quote unquote making sense. And so the question is, why do we have to add? Why should we add all that extra stuff above and beyond the sort of pragmatic, just getting your words in the right place? That I probably didn't even do with that. Okay, thanks.
Well, let me make sure I understand the question, Roger. Rationality means you were describing kind of verbal competence in being able to speak coherently, which is a practical skill and an aspect of it's a function of the rational faculty that we have language, and language is, you know, works only when you put sentences together coherently. That's just one particular form of it. But rationality means exercising your mind to grasp reality as it is, to make your conclusions and your decisions based on what you observe in the world and what you infer from it by logical, rational methods. Now, I want to mention one other thing that in economics, there's a concept of rationality as maximizing utility, doing what it takes to figuring out how to get what you want. And often the idea is that what you want is a matter of your emotions and desires, which are not rational. The whole function of reason is to figure out the means of satisfying those desires. This goes back to, or was made famous by David Hume, 18th century philosopher, who said, you know, reason is and ought to be a slave of the passions, meaning just an instrument for achieving something, but not applicable. Rationality is not applicable to the ends of goals, values we seek. And that is not what objectivism means by it. Rationality as the exercise of your cognitive ability to use reason to acquire knowledge and to make choices requires that you be rational about moral values as well, moral issues. What's good in life? What virtues, what principles of action should I go by in order to achieve a happy life, which also includes understanding that happiness includes good relationships with other people, not for purposes of sacrifice, but for purposes of conducting trade, learning from other people, having good, having, you know, satisfying, healthy relationships. So I sense that the issue you're raising has to do with what is sometimes called instrumental rationality, just as a tool, but not as an all-comprehensive means of living.
And so the question is, you know, I'm on the street talking to Joe. Hey, come be an objectivist. come be a Randian, right? And you know, I've got to give them a reason for why rationality, which is like the virtue of objectivism, I think. Why it has to encompass all those other things, which could be considered, you know, distinct or for other, you know, be something else rather than combined all into this one thing. So I guess you laid out the two positions. So, and maybe I'm asking way too much here from you, but why choose the one where it's all combined into one thing rather than the one where it's, you know, split up into distinct features that you can, you know, do what you can do with decomposed properties?
Well, I guess the reason is that, rationality involves a lot of different components, as I was saying in answer to Scott's original question. And you can break it down and focus on one at a time. Like, as I said, I'm a logic teacher, so I'm teaching logic. I'm helping my students understand, for example, how to define a concept or how to evaluate an inference. But the reason that rationality is an all-encompassing thing is that if you peel something off from rationality, some aspect of life or some kind of issue, if you're not using reason, what are you using? Emotions? Faith? Reliance on some authority? Those are not rational. And if someone is doing that, then I have to ask, why do you think that's a reliable way of acquiring knowledge or making decisions? And there's no answer to that. I mean, reason is the tool we use even in evaluating the scope of reason versus any other method of acquiring knowledge.
I was just going to say, asking the reason why kind of almost assumes the value of rationality.
So I will stop after this next follow-up, I promise. So one option, they would be like method, right? So rather than combining it all into rationality and say that, well, you know, I can be rational in terms of maybe putting together my sentences, maybe I can even be rational about ethics, but then when it comes to, say, discovering a fact, I rely on a method rather than a rationality. I imagine you'd say, well, the method itself has to be rational, but you know, other people might disagree with that. So I don't know, if you want to address that, great. If not, I totally understand that. Maybe it's not an issue.
Thanks, Roger. David, do you have more to say, or can we?
No, let's move on.
Okay. Dana, thank you for your patience. You appear to be unmuted now.
Yes, I got rid of all the operator errors. it seems to me like that psychology is driving towards establishing a set of factors that are deterministic in terms of behavior. And we know that there's lots of evidence for personality and predispositions for certain behaviors. But I still want to believe in free will, but I want objective proof of free will. And the question is, how do I get that? I don't want to do it through introspection, because that throws it back into the realm of pseudoscience and non-objectivity. So help me design an experiment that would show that people do have free will.
Okay. I need to question the assumptions here, because I think free will is a self-evident fact if we examine our thinking and we can be directly aware of the choice to focus and on a fact or evade it, the choice of how clear our focus is on a given issue, and whether to allow or not allow irrational factors to influence our thinking. So just as, in the theory of objectivism, there are certain axioms or axiomatic things that we observe directly. We observe directly that things exist, that whatever exists has identity, and that we are conscious. And I would say those things that are self-evident, what self-evidence means is that they are directly available to our immediate awareness. Now, we put them into words and as axioms, but it's really the direct observation. So you said you didn't want to rely on introspection, and I know that in psychology, and this may be the historical or the context you're thinking of, people have discounted introspection as a method and in favor of third-party experimentations, where you have a subject, you have an experimenter, and you create a task, and then you that's designed to show one thing or another, and then you see what the results are. But that would never work for free will, because whatever the outcome of the experiment is, there will always be two interpretations. One is that the person was influenced by the factors you provided, and some people will be, and others will not be influenced by those, or will be influenced but will reconsider and say, no, that's not going to govern my decision. So I think you have to include the inner direct awareness, introspection, if you will, as a source of valid evidence. But I also want to say that there's a longstanding philosophical fact about things that are axiomatic, is that they cannot be denied without self-contradiction. For example, if I say nothing exists, well, that statement by an existing person, myself, contradicts the content of what I'm saying. There's nothing exists. That's too obvious. But in the case of free will, there's a longstanding argument or consideration, the contradiction of determinism, that if you are advocating determinism and giving an argument for it, then I can always ask you, do you think that argument is valid? And, or were you just expressing that argument because you were determined by antecedent factors like your breeding or your situation or your hormones or your brain state or whatever. And if you can't answer, no, I thought about this. I've really weighed the issues, and I've come out on the side of determinism. But you got there without any ability to choose whether to, how to weigh the evidence and whether to accept it or not, is incompatible with the determinist thesis you're putting forward. Now, I don't consider that an argument for people. I think the main point is the interest, direct awareness of it. But it's kind of a confirmation.
So you're saying that determinism is, the idea of determinism is self-contradictory.
Yes. The idea, the expression, the assertion of the idea is self-contradictory because it's not compatible with the content of the assertion is not compatible with the fact that you are asserting it as true.
Okay. Well, Dana, thank you for that. I do want to get Karthik in here. And, if anyone else has a question, you're welcome to come up on the stage. We do have some others from Instagram and other channels as well. Karthik, thank you for your patience.
I have a silly question. Is relationships are really necessary in your life?
Can you say that one more time?
Is relationship is really necessary in life?
I'm sorry, I couldn't really hear that.
Maybe closer to the mic?
No?
I can hear you better, yes.
Yeah, is relationship is really necessary in life?
Are relationships really necessary in life?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Human beings are individuals, and it's conceivable that, you know, the proverbial man on a desert island could survive, produce what he needed, find food, and so forth. But human beings are social animals, if you understand social animals in the proper sense, that we gain huge amounts from relationships. Just starting with the economic, we all benefit from trade within an economy based on the division of labor. We're all much, much better off functioning in that kind of environment in terms of wealth and prosperity and safety than we would be on a desert island. But there's also the emotional needs. I think in objectivism, one of the values, for example, is romantic love. And there's a reason why that is a strong desire and a valid and important value for human beings, in that it provides us with a kind of access to our own person. The Aristotle once said, the friend is a mirror of the self. But you see things in a mirror that you can't see when you're not looking in the mirror. That is, people, someone who knows and loves you for what you are can bring out and make you aware of things about yourself that you experience that you otherwise would experience only internally. But it's an important value in one's sense of one's own identity, which is something you need very much in order to have the strength and direction to lead a happy life. There's a lot of psychology behind what I'm saying, and so I can't summarize it all here. But I think relationships, so quick answer to your question, Karthik, is theoretically, relationships are not essential in the way that food and air are essential to human life. but they are so important in making life better that I would consider them genuine human needs.
It's good stuff. The fact that it's considered torture in some places for solitary confinement is probably some indication of being seen as universal. James, welcome to the stage. Thank you. Do you have a question?
Thank you. Yes, I do. Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for taking my question. Can you hear me all right?
I can, yes.
I was wondering, somewhere in one of his writings, which I don't have at hand right now, Nathaniel Brandon said something along the lines that he knew which things had been proved and which things hadn't in objectivism. And I, what you think, if indeed you agree with him?
That is another, really interesting question. Let me come at it a bit indirectly. Some years ago, I developed a system of outlining the objectivist philosophy in terms of logical diagrams, argument diagrams that are commonly used in logic books, showing, you know, what are the premises that lead to this conclusion? What are the premises that lead to that?
Yes, I have a copy of it, actually.
The logical structure of objectivism.
Indeed, which never came out in print. Most disappointingly.
I'm sorry. We tried many times to interest a publisher. And we just couldn't.
I would suggest self-publishing.
Maybe that's more.
Happy to collaborate with you. Now. Happy to collaborate with you on that if you're interested.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'd be interested in following up on that with you, James. But the in that book, what we tried to do was to say, you know, what is the evidence for each of the main theses of objectivism? Yeah. Both the evidence that comes from more fundamental principles, and then at each stage, what is the inductive evidence that we get from observation and from history, psychology, and other empirical fields? And there were cases where we felt, yeah, this needs more attention. We're not sure about exactly, is this argument fully strong? You know, overall, I would say, you know, objectivism is a remarkably integrated and well-supported philosophy, but it's an entire system of philosophy. And one of the reasons that I am interested, one of my goals as a philosopher who's, you know, was all my life I've been an objectivist, but it's been a foundation and a realm in which I want to explore and deepen and see and keep checking. Is this point really established? Is there nothing you can say against it? And I think there's an abundant room for elaborating and more fully explaining or justifying.
Yeah.
Providing evidence for a number of points. And I've done some of that in my own work. Others have done that. Nathaniel Brandon himself, I think it really expanded the theory of self-esteem. So it's not so much that there are, you know, that you put it, I want to qualify this a little bit by saying whether a thesis of a philosophical sort is proven or not is it's not an open or shut question like you ask about, you know, is this math proof sound? If it is, you're done. In philosophy and in many other fields, evidence accumulates. And sometimes, you know, you learn new things that say, well, okay, now I understand more fully why this is true, or I understand that it needs to be qualified in certain ways. And it's an ongoing process. So, but I don't know. I'm not familiar with the Brandon statement. I can't remember seeing that or hearing it from him on that point. So I'm just saying what I think from my experience. But I'm delighted to know that you've got a copy of The Logical Structure. It's on our website, by the way, if anyone wants to look for it, just search on Logical Structure of Objectivism.
Great. A little new reading there. And again, we want to invite anyone up to the stage that has a question.
I just have one last point. I would just say that I heartily endorse that. I think everyone here would be very interested by the logical structure of objectivism. And if I might just ask one last follow-up before you move on, it is just, do you recall which areas just under the covers amongst friends you thought were the shakiest or the most need of additional work?
There are a couple of areas. In my field, epistemology, I think one issue that I don't feel has been thoroughly established is the idea of certainty. Under what conditions and can we claim to be certain of a certain conclusion? Obviously, that bears a pretty close relationship to your question.
No, I think that's very good. Yes. And whether you can be certain and wrong.
Yes. And that's another one. Right. So, I mean, that's part of that whole epistemological mix. Another one that we've tried to address at the Atlas Society, Rand did not write much about the ethics of families. And I don't think we mentioned that very much in the Logical Structure book. But that's an important part of a lot of people's lives. And it raises some unique questions because, most of the objective theory about interpersonal relationships has to do with chosen relationships among friends, lovers, and trading partners. But families, you don't choose your parents, and parents don't quite choose their children. They choose whether to have them, but not what they end up with. So, There are some other considerations here that I think we've only begun to appreciate and analyze.
Well, thank you for those.
Thank you for that. Again, anyone is welcome to the stage. If you have a question, you want to raise your hand. I'm going to go back. They still were some interesting ones on across the different channels that came in from Atlas Society fans. This one may be a little bit related. In your opinion, how is objectivism different from narcissism and hedonism?
Like night and day? narcissism is... technically it's a psychological, not psychosis, but neurosis. Sometimes it's psychosis. It is a deep disruption in one's sense of confidence in oneself. You normally can base an inner sense of absence that has to be supplemented or substituted by some kind of constant affirmation from other people, which is pretty much the polar opposite of the objectivist virtue and ideal of independence. Hedonism is maybe a little less inimical, but hedonism is a view that, at least as an ethical theory, that the measure of what's good and bad is what yields pleasure or avoids pain. And pain and pleasure, or happiness and suffering, you want to use those terms, are not a criteria for value. We feel happy about the things when we achieve, we feel happy when we achieve the things that we value, but valuing them has to come first. If you are a sadist and you value pain, causing pain in other people, that may provide, a hedonic satisfaction to you, but it's irrational. And I mean, when it's psychologically based, it's a psychological problem, disruption, something wrong with you. But if, so we can't go by simply what gives people pleasure. I mean, I mentioned sadism, that's a standard, classroom example. But a lot of people who like power and love to get their joy from wielding power over others. There are people who love to be prominent and famous, celebrities, and get lots of love and attention from people. Ayn Rand wrote about all these types of characters in The Fountainhead especially, and why they were, unlike Howard Roark, they all came to grief because that is not a, they were relying on their emotions essentially to guide their lives instead of on their reason and their long-term goals. So objectivism is not hedonism. It is, as I was saying before in answer to an earlier question, it does aim at the happiness, if we consider happiness as achievement and satisfaction over a lifetime, not momentary pleasure.
Yeah, I guess what some people might do is misuse definitions of the philosophy where they're disregarding their long-term self-interest, but they say, oh, I'm being selfish about this.
Right. Well, that's another, I think, confusion, identifying selfishness with immediate pleasure, especially material pleasures, money, sex, gluttony, whatever. And the in disregard of the longer term consequences like hangover, whatever. So, human life is just, again, I'm hitting on a theme of rationality. We live in a moment that is at any moment we are where we are right now. But our minds can grasp that we have a past, we have a future, and we're headed for the future, and we have goals and aims, and that is as important as stopping to smell the flowers right now.
Good stuff. Thank you for that. Now I've got sirens behind me. William, thank you for your patience.
Yes. Hello. Hi, David.
Hey.
I have maybe a kind of weird question about rights, individual rights. I have re-entered the abortion debate with some anti-abortion Rand fans, and they're bringing up the issue that the fetus has a brain and brain activity and conscious awareness, or maybe like sensory awareness, and they're saying that makes it a person or like a someone that potentially has rights. And so the issue I'm tackling with is the fact that you have one body, the mother with the fetus, but two brains in that body. And this reminds mm-hmm. me of like the problem of Siamese twins, where there's a one body and two brains, and then they're fighting over control. What do you make of this problem? And do you think it's important in regard to individual rights?
Well, first of all, I appreciate that abortion is is a morally complicated issue and politically complicated issue, because it's not a case of my rights being and the mother's rights being, you know, like the welfare state was going to take, is going to tax her to pay for someone else who's a recipient. No, this is claim of a fetus's rights versus the mother's rights. It's rights versus rights. So we need to adjudicate it within the framework of individual rights. I would say that the mother's rights are, you know, decisive until the point of birth, because as long as the fetus depends on her for its sustenance, its life, it's not an independent entity. And the whole idea of individualism of the, you know, every individual is an end in himself applies to people, human beings, who are at least physically independent, which is not the case. Now, we get into an area here. So I would say that trumps any argument about what the stage of development in the fetus, particularly as it becomes, there's signs of conscious awareness and pain and pleasure and so forth.
Yeah, that's kind of my thinking as well. It's more about the independence or the dependence of the fetus on the mother, not only just in the fact that she feeds the baby the fluids to keep it alive, but the baby is not breathing its own air. It's not actually using its core functions to survive.
Right. And it's not using its mind to govern its actions in the same way that even a newborn does, primitive and helpless as the newborn may be, and dependent, but in a different sense for nurturing. I mean, one thing I'd want to stress here is that, you know, birth is a biological fact. The development, this is how human beings, like other animals, come into existence, and you can't argue with facts. Facts are facts. So we have to make our philosophy, we have to make the best interpretation we can. And if we take a theory of individual rights that is developed basically for how adults relate to each other, well, you can extend that back and make modifications as to earlier stages, pre-adult. For example, I would say that once a baby is born, it has a right to life, but does not have a full right to liberty or to property. Parents still are morally entitled to, I think they're obligated to feed and care for the baby, but also to, they have, you know, the responsibility of guiding it until it can make its own decisions. The young person can make his or her own decisions about, and the mind has developed far enough to do that. But so rights are, the objective theory of rights is that it depends on human nature, and human nature develops over time. That's just a fact of nature. So we have to adjust our concepts that were like a concept of rights that was developed in a certain context based on the needs of adults, the adult human nature, to as best we can adapt it. But I think that I agree that the dependence issue is the key one. But I don't want to leave this issue without, you know, trying to counter any sense of, hard-heartedness. I think the vast majority of women and parents too, fathers too, have babies because they want them. They care about them. There's nature has also instilled certain desires in us that are pretty natural, of caring, nurturing, and it's so. I think it is both a woman's right, but also a kind of tragedy if she gets to the point of feeling I must end this life within me.
Fair distinction. I appreciate that. George, I've seen you in the healthy debates with Roger. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Can you hear me okay? I just sound put great. On my AirPod.
Yep.
Okay. Fantastic. Okay. So what prompted me to come up was when you started talking about sadism and masochism. And I must be one or both of those, because I find myself championing the cause of capitalism in communist and socialist rooms, and trying to sharpen the saw and constantly getting booted out of the rooms. But you know what I find it does, Dr. Kelly, is it kind of like when I get backed into a corner for something maybe I hadn't thought about, then I'm up all night thinking about it. And so they stumped me with one thing, and I wanted to run it by you. So the situation came up where there was an imaginary scenario where you're in the middle of the Sahara, and there's an oasis, and some sheikh owns the oasis. Does he have a right to prevent, because he owns it, it's his property, to prevent some traveler who's dying of thirst? Does he have a moral right, or is he in the right to prevent that person from taking a drink of water?
Well, here's another case where we are trying to apply the theory of rights to a situation somewhat outside the realm of where it normally would apply, because the idea of property rights is bound up with the idea of trade, and not you can own property and not be interested in trade and keep out strangers.
What was that second word? I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Own property, not be interested in what?
In trade.
Oh,
trading
got
with
it.
Other people. However, the reason that rights work within an economy, why they have good results in a capitalist system, is that if I want to get, you have a supply of water and I'm thirsty and you don't want to sell it or give it to me, there's other places I can get water. Here we've created a situation where there isn't. So now we have to ask, is this context of the oasis and rare travelers who just stumble into it, a normal, within the context of the normal situations to which the concept of rights applies. You know, if there are many scenarios, then these have been debated in objectivist circles and libertarian circles for a long time. You know, you're caught in a blizzard and you come across a cabin that where you can take shelter, but the person doesn't want to do it. Look, at the end of the day, your life is the most important thing to you. If you're in a situation where it is impossible to respect another person's rights by not exercising any use of force, then you may need to use force. It's a lifeboat situation, right? Where the conditions a raging fire and you're caught in a building, you have to do what you can to survive yourself and get back to a normal situation. So, but before I would answer that question, I would say, what is the traveler doing out in the desert without enough water? What was he thinking? How did he know? Did he know where this oasis was? Was he counting on the oasis? to provide water? Why? You know, what I just hate these thought experiments where people come up with a bizarre situation and drop the context of how that situation occurred.
You know, Dr. Kelly, just so you know, I actually didn't answer it. I flipped it on him and I said, hey, if I own a lake, you know, that connects to a river, are you telling me I don't have the right to build a dam? And of course, you know, he wouldn't answer that. So we ended up not answering each other's questions. But I understand the person who's traveling that he would have to resort to force, right? Because, you know, a moral system is about the survival of the individual, so long as it doesn't interfere in somebody else's rights. I get that. What trumped me was if I myself were the owner, of course I would let the guy have water, but I'm just saying the owner in relation to him, how would you answer it?
Well, okay, that's great, because that's the other part of the context. Why is this Oasis owner not willing to give or at least sell water? What kind of craziness is that? I mean, you have to have a pretty pessimistic view of human nature to think that.
That's a socialist for you.
Listen, right? I'm sorry to yeah. break this up, but and feel free to make a last point, Dr. Kelly. But we are at the bottom of the hour.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, thanks, everyone, for these great questions. I'm sorry I couldn't get to everyone, I will be back. I do one of these every month, so I hope to see all of you again. And thank you, Scott, for your able management.
Absolutely. This has been a great session with some good questions. I'm just going to say quickly, tonight at 8 p.m., about 90 minutes from now, Richard Salzman will be hosting his series Morals and Markets, which Central Bank Digital Currencies, What's the Point? That seems pretty interesting. That's on the atlassociety.org. Anyway, thank you again for joining us. I'm Scott Schiff for the Atlas Society, and we hope to see you next time.
Thank you.